Hey there, better leaders. My name is Danny Sunshine, host of this podcast, and my mission in life is to help school leaders fight isolation and frustration via a leadership community in order to gain clarity and find solutions to their greatest challenges. If you get value from today's show at all, you can show me some love back by subscribing to this podcast and leaving a rating and review where you're listening right now. I can serve more school leaders by having a better ranking, and that's tied 100% to subscriptions, reviews, and shares on social media. In today's show, I talk with Julia Freeland Fisher, and we explore a number of interesting topics like addressing the opportunity gap in education, what schools can do when students lack sufficient care and support networks, and the difference between strong ties versus weak ties. Thanks for spending some time with me listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoy this show. And before we jump into the episode, let's take some time to thank our show sponsors. A lot of school leaders talk about improving student soft skills to help them succeed in their rigorous coursework. The problem is that most leaders just talk about it without actually doing anything. You can improve your students' non-cognitive skills today by checking out an amazing program called Organized Binder. Learn more at organizedbinder.com. Students who participate in the Conrad Challenge don't learn to think outside the box. There is no box. Learn how innovation takes off and soars beyond the confines of a box at conradchallenge.org.
I'm Jethro Jones from Transformative Principal, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual hosts. Make sure you check out the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. And get ready because the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
Well, hey there, better leaders. Excited to talk with a new author here today on the show, Julia Freeland Fisher. And she's a director of education research at the Clayton Christensen Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. She leads a team devoted to informing policymakers and community leaders on the power of disruptive innovation to transform schools. She also has a new book out, Who You Know, Unlocking Innovations That Expand Students' Networks. And in that book, authors Julia Freeland Fisher and Daniel Fisher explore a fresh perspective, giving educators and school administrators a model for breaking the pattern of inequality in the classroom. While discussions about inequality in education often focus on achievement gaps, opportunity is more than just test scores. Opportunity sits at the cross-section of what students know and whom they know. Welcome to the show, Julia.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Let's jump right into the book. Normally, I have some warm-up questions, but I want to hear, because, you know, a long time ago, I heard that your net worth is equal to your network. Yeah. And in some senses, you know, I think your book addresses that, but then how can we provide better access and open more doors for our students? So can you tell us a story of writing Who You Know, Unlocking Innovations That Expand Students' Network?
Totally, yeah. So, I mean, I think when I first joined the Christensen Institute, where I work about 5 years ago, we were writing a lot about the rise of technology in classrooms, which I remain really passionate about. But I had this lurking suspicion that we weren't talking about the whole of the opportunity equation and also the whole of the potential of technology to address opportunity gaps. Because certainly in the United States, the sort of mainstream education conversation focuses so acutely on the achievement gap and on test scores. And of course, those of us who work in any pocket of the labor market know that what you know really matters. But I think that we're selling kids and families and communities an incomplete message, because the fact of the matter is that half of jobs come through personal connections, and that access to a network really has enormous leverage when it comes to accessing opportunity. And so I wanted to look at, are schools even thinking about this network piece? And if they are, how are they innovating both inside of their classrooms and in their communities and globally using technology to really tap into new networks for their students? So that was really the impetus of, I felt like we were having a really incomplete conversation about how kids can access opportunity.
Yeah, and it's an important topic. You know, when I taught in Chicago Public Schools, for example, you see just the sheer amount of opportunity that's there in a big city, right? Like third largest in the nation, third largest school district. And sometimes the lack of opportunity and resources within given communities. So I know my why and, you know, why I was at that school. But I'm curious for you, why does this topic matter so much to you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think in a very personal sense, I think I just entered adulthood totally naive as to the role of networks. And I grew up with a lot of access and privilege and, you know, extracurriculars and all that, but was just naive and felt like if I were naive, even with all the resources that were thrown at my childhood, like, what are we thinking about more broadly in the education system about the role of networks? And my husband had a sort of similar experience who you mentioned. I wrote the book with my husband, which is maybe a topic for a totally separate podcast. But, you know, he got out of college and joined the military and literally had never met anyone in the military before that from sort of our generation or even, frankly, like close to his parents' generation. And so I think both of us were just really aware of how much in our 20s we sort of came to realize the power of networks and wanted to think about how do we make more people and more institutions sort of aware of that power.
And something I found interesting in the book is just the discussion around social capital.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, you know, how you might define that for our listeners and why certain relationships offer different types of benefits.
Totally. Yeah. So social capital is this term we actually joke in the book, or it's like a geeky joke, but that in the academy,
those are the best kind.
The best kind of joke. Yeah, you know, there's like over 20 or 30 definitions in the academy of like what social capital means. So it's certainly like a sometimes fraught or capacious term. But the gist of it in economics and sociology, people talk about human capital, what you know that the labor market will pay you to do. But there's this term social capital, which is who you know and the fact that networks contain real value, just like a dollar contains value, your network contains value. And part of the point we want to make in the book is that that's all well and good, but different relationships at different times in our lives provide different value. And one of the ways we break that down that I think for educators will resonate is the difference between strong ties and weak ties. And this is a term of art that a lot of sociologists use. And our strong ties are those kind of in our inner circle who really help us get by. They're those who are more likely to lend us resources, with whom we spend more time. They really look out for us. But we also, all of us, have weak ties, which are sort of our looser acquaintances and those with whom we may spend less time. And the kind of counterintuitive fact of the matter is that in the sort of late 70s, a researcher named Mark Granovetter started to study how people got jobs and actually found that probabilistically, you were more likely to find a job through your weak tie network. And he coined this term, the strength of weak ties, which is to say all of those sort of looser acquaintances themselves contain value because they can open new doors to opportunity. And I like that frame when we get into the education conversation, because I think conventional wisdom in schools is the stronger the connection, the better. That's why a lot of teachers join the teaching profession. It's why mentors want to work with young people. But I think that's an incomplete look at the sort of networks we might want to arm students with, because weak ties can also offer value as well. So the book really, it's a book about both how to shore up a strong tie network around young people and also diversify a weak tie network at their disposal.
Yeah. So just reflect back and make sure I'm tracking with you. Those, you saw that the weak ties actually are the ones that are acting almost as pathways to jobs and that kind of thing. So something that I might just discount even because of the term, the label.
The term. Weak tie.
Yeah, like, yeah. I need the weak tie. Those don't do nothing for me. But you're finding that people are actually finding jobs and they offer tremendous value in relationships.
Yeah, and I'll be just, I mean, clearly I'm a little wonky, so just bear with me and let me be wonky for one more second here and then we can get back to some stories and examples. But
yeah.
The research on this is really interesting, and you're seeing new research come out more and more because we have sort of social networks like LinkedIn and Facebook where you can study this stuff at scale. Controlling for all else, I'm more likely to get a job through a strong tie. But because I have more weak ties at a time and I can maintain more of them at a time,
right,
that's where the probability goes way up. So that's one fact to keep in mind. So if you know exactly what you want to do and the company you want to work at, like, go cultivate a strong tie there. But most of our young people, right, are not at that place yet. And so cultivating a diverse array of weak ties also makes sense. And so that's just a little nuance on this idea. And the other thing that some sociologists have studied is that weak tie networks, because there are more people in them, right? So you may have 5 very close friends and 100 much, much less intimate friendships. Those 100 contain more diverse information. 5 people you know the best, because the 5 people you know the best are actually more likely to know one another. And so the information they possess is redundant. Mm-hmm. So I know that's like a lot of wonky sort of abstract terminology, but it is really important to think about, as your life evolves, all the sorts of connections that can have value. And I just think we're not messaging that as clearly as we could to young people, or frankly, building schools in a way that set people up to have diverse networks.
Mm. Because if those 5 strong ties all know each other and they're sharing a redundant message, you could be existing in a bubble. Is that right?
Yeah, it can become an echo chamber, right? And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That can have all sorts of care and assets contained in it. But when you then, if you grow up and you've never met a neurosurgeon and you want to go study brain science, like how are you going to network into that field? And so we just want to think about how networks really shape optionality and opportunity and what that could mean about sort of school design as we know it.
So what have you seen schools do that works, especially if their students are maybe under-resourced or don't have those stronger developed networks? What could we do to help?
Yeah, so we ended up studying, I would sort of, to oversimplify, say like 3 main types of innovation that we got really excited about. And the first was around just creating more, and as someone who's worked in Chicago Public Schools, I think you can appreciate this, creating more coherent ways that schools are working with community agencies to ensure that students have access to a web of caring adults in their lives. So mentors, people working in after school programs, and families, and sort of connecting all those dots around a young person. And the program we thought was probably one of the best examples nationally of that is a program out of Boston called City Connects that places a school site coordinator in every school who can sort of get to know each student and family and the community agencies around that school and really create a coherent kind of web around them. So that's one sort of innovation that I think, frankly, anyone who has lived the No Child Left Behind era can appreciate. Like, we have not done a very well-coordinated effort at poverty relief in tandem with trying to improve academics. And I think that's one of the main reasons the achievement gap really hasn't budged. So that's like one species of innovation. A second totally different species of innovation, getting into that weak tie conversation, is the role of technology to network students with people they might otherwise not meet. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned the neurosurgeon example, right? Mm-hmm. So what we looked at were technologies like a tool called Nephris, another tool called EduCurious, that are essentially using fairly affordable video chat technology, like what you and I are using right now on Zoom, to pour experts into classrooms over video chat so that students are meeting people who may work in professions that they've never met someone who works in that profession, particularly if they're living in rural communities or if their parents are less well-networked into the knowledge economy. Another one of those tools called Dreamwakers that I really love has worked really hard to recruit role models for students with whom they can identify. So particularly Latino and Black professionals who can come into classrooms over video chat and talk to classrooms of young people who can look up to them and sort of see themselves in a variety of professions in the knowledge economy. So that's a very different species of innovation. That's much less about sort of poverty relief and networks of care, but it's, we would argue, planting the seeds of sort of new weak tie networks in students' lives that could really prove powerful down the line. The last, and then I promise I'll stop talking, but I think this is equally important for people working in classrooms and thinking about their local assets, are sort of efforts to bring outsiders into schools as guest speakers, but in much more comprehensive and regular ways than happen sort of by chance now. And those are happening through platforms like Community Share, and Real World Scholars, which are essentially trying to create sort of Craigslist for teachers, where they can go on and see all the local assets that they could invite into their classrooms that could complement or supplement a lesson plan. And equally important, I think, are schools, particularly high schools, that are starting to let kids out into the community to work in internships or job shadows. And again, we sort of tracked a number of platforms that are making that much more feasible, sort of lowering the price tag of that for schools, like InBlaze and Big Picture Learning. So those are the three big buckets. Like, what are we doing to kind of shore up a student's network of caring adults? What are we doing to maybe leverage technology to let them meet people they may never have met? And then lastly, what are we doing to sort of start to make school more porous so that more outsiders are coming into the classroom on a volunteer basis and more kids are getting out to learn from those around them in their community?
Right. And that could be as deep and I won't say job embedded for the kid. They don't mm-hmm. have a job yet, but it's those real world authentic experiences. Or it could be strengthening those weak ties by utilizing the emerging tech that's available to us these days.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'd say two examples that I've continued to be really excited about since writing the book sort of illustrate that spectrum you just described. So Big Picture Learning, I don't know if you've heard of them, but they've been around for about three decades doing internship-based learning for high schoolers. Okay. And in those cases, students are out in an internship 3 days a week. And it's an enduring relationship with that host sort of volunteer who's mentoring them at a job site and really becomes a very involved relationship in a lot of ways. So that's one model. A different model is a newer model out of Los Angeles called DaVinci X. And what DaVinci X is doing is they felt like internships were almost too much time spent out of school at a job site. And it felt like they were losing critical, valuable learning time in school. And so they've shrunken sort of their quote unquote internships down to what they call project consultancies, which are sort of 8 to 12 hour engagements with local employers that are still offering that connection, that relationship, mm-hmm. and that sort of real world content, but not necessarily taking up as much of the sort of in-school learning time. So I think that spectrum is what we would use, again, forgive the long chronology, but sort of dosage question of how much is the right dosage of out-of-school learning. I think different schools are playing with that in really interesting and exciting ways for those of us who want to see a more open network model of school in the future.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think of like minimum effective doses or like 80-20, yep. like just the idea that to get the maximum value, maybe the inputs of what we do don't have to be so vast. Like yeah. that is that small enough dose that it'll drive what we're looking for our kids.
Exactly. And I think all of us know that sort of dollars are obviously an exceedingly scarce resource in schools, but time is our other very scarce resource, right? And so playing with that feels important as we're trying to sort of add new things into young people's experiences.
Yeah, I'm in the midst of a research project talking to a bunch of school leaders myself, and that issue of time keeps coming up. I know that that's something I'll have to address at some point, but yeah, you're right. Time, I think, is probably the major resource for school leaders, you know, that they're challenged with, for sure.
Absolutely. And again, that's where we get excited. I'm not particularly excited about technology for technology's sake. Like, I'd rather be like hanging out with you probably face-to-face than doing this over Zoom. But when you think about it as a way to shrink time commitments, even for the volunteers that might be coming into schools and talking about their professional experiences, suddenly it starts to grow the pie of what's possible mm-hmm. in a single school day or school year.
Well, the funny thing about that, Julia, is, and some listeners, older listeners definitely have heard this story, newer ones might not as much, but the podcast started, you know, in the mastermind with my leadership community for school leaders.
Yeah.
It started because of maybe a lack of time. Like, I wanted to do local events, right? Local dinners where school leaders all around, there's plenty of school leaders to choose from in Chicago. And it was just too much of a challenge time-wise to get together. Maybe it was the traffic, the kids, or whatever. And the paradox for me, my experience was that when I opened up, let's have this authentic conversation with the world, right? There's a leadership community, 45 members at the time of this recording from 8 different countries in the world. So I went from Chicago to global and my bucket's getting filled and I'm getting to serve school leaders. It's insane. And I never would have guessed that. I much rather would have the face-to-face too, but I'm going with the doors that's open and getting to meet a lot of interesting people that way.
And seeing the potential for scale that then unlocks, right? Which
for
I
sure.
think is where we get excited as well.
Mm.
Just to geek out on one more layer of that, as I sort of poo-poo technology on this. But another thing we thought about a lot, and where we get pushback, frankly, when I talk about some of the technology tools that we're sort of inspired by, is that you worry that you can't form an authentic connection over a digital interface. And researchers like Sherry Turkle from MIT have written extensively about the kind of decline of empathy with the rise of technologically mediated interactions. But there's two things I would push on there. And these are just, I think this is helpful for educators thinking about kind of putting students in relationship with people. One is that as technology is improving, we actually, you can get closer to sort of the markers of empathy. So a text versus a video, you actually are able to feel more empathy over video chat because it's more multimodal. And we sort of predict in the book that that's only going to get better and better. So I think there's like some hope there, not to say that we want to just have screens all day, every day for the rest of our lives. The other thing that I'm really interested in though, and I wonder if you did this when you were having these leadership chats, sounds like there was a sort of shared purpose already, is that trust is born out of a sense of similarity. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about whether it's an online or offline interaction between a student and someone she may never have met before, I think having protocols to surface similarity is just as critical as whether the modality is face-to-face or online. An example we talk about in the book that some of your listeners may have heard of is a group called Empatico.org. It's an effort of the Kind Bar Foundation, like the gluten-free nut bars. And they worked with a different organization called EduCurious that does some of these expert video chats in a project-based learning context, and created a protocol where you just go back and forth. You say something about yourself, and if you have experienced the same, if the other person's experienced the same thing, they can say me too. And if not, they say something about themselves, and you go back and forth. And it's a quick protocol to establish what might otherwise be a hidden similarity. And I just think the power of that, particularly in some of these online environments, to create trust, to forge a sense of similarity, as opposed to having these kind of like creepy mediated screen conversations that make us into robots, I think we can really start to humanize these interactions both online and off. So that's just riffing on this idea of like, is this future going to be sort of bleak and digital or kind of more abundant than what we've known?
Yeah, we're gonna hold on to that abundant point of view for sure.
Okay.
Julia, I'm really enjoying this conversation, but let's pause here for just a moment for a message from our sponsors. Today's show is proudly sponsored by Organized Binder, a program which gives students daily exposure to goal setting, reflective learning, time and task management, study strategies, organization skills, and more. Organized Binder's color-coded system is implemented by the teacher through parallel process with students, helping them create a predictable and dependable classroom routine. You can learn more and improve your students' executive functioning and non-cognitive skills at organizedbinder.com. All right, and we're back with Julia Freeland Fisher, and we're talking about her new book, Who You Know, Unlocking Innovations That Expand Students' Networks. I have only one more question, which is really, did I miss anything? But I want to share a quote that really meant a lot to me. It says, or you say, schools are no different as core institutions in their communities. Schools have the potential to dramatically shape the networks at their students' disposal. Schools could play a leading role in stating to tackle long-standing relationship gaps among America's children. And I so appreciate that because, you know, in the leadership community or my one-on-one coaching practice, it's all about helping people see the choices they have, right? Because a lot of times it feels like our hands are tied, that the challenges and problems that we need to solve are just insurmountable. But we often have quite a bit of autonomy and choice within that. And so I appreciate what you shared there. So is there anything else about the book that we didn't talk about that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, just knowing it's the leadership community, I guess that's a favorite audience of mine, because I think as much as I have such deep respect for anyone running schools nowadays, because it's a really hard job, it's also the people in the system who I think have the most flexibility to design and to redesign. And with that in mind, like a couple things came to mind. The first is some recent research that just came out last month showing that in a set of Michigan schools, this is from an Ohio State University study, and I can send you the link if you want to post alongside the podcast, but that social capital within a school system seemed to matter just as much as financial resources. So the relationships across that school system were critical to getting better results. And so I think as much as I'm passionate about students' networks as an equity issue, I think leaders thinking about their systems as a network is a really powerful frame to sort of get the most out of both the adults and young people working in that system. So that's just one thing I'd say to the leadership community. I think the second thing I'd just say is that, you know, I think that the test score culture, and I'm not anti-testing, but we all know the sort of downsides of that, the test score culture and the sort of college application gauntlet and all of these things have made us think of students as individuals. But the reality is we don't accomplish things alone in life. And so I think the more that leaders can think of their students as individuals within networks and networks that they could potentially expand and start to take sort of the chance out of chance encounter, the more we're actually setting young people up for success.
That's a really interesting idea to end on there. Just thinking about kids, not just as individuals, but as their collective networks. So, you know, you got to nerd out a bit, and there's some questions that I have to ask because my listeners demand that I do, and then we'll wrap up today's show.
Right.
But Julia, what is one book, video, tool, or resource that's really impacted your quality of life in the last 90 days?
Oh my gosh. My quality of life. Okay. So I have to say a book and then maybe just a practice. So the book I actually just read is called How to Live Forever by Mark Friedman. And it's all about intergenerational connections, which we didn't talk about here, but like will blow your mind in terms of sort of the untapped potential of our older and like retired communities and what they could offer to schools and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So that was, I just found inspiring, and it's really story driven. It's way less wonky than clearly I am as a writer and thinker. So I appreciated that. But in terms of quality of life, I am a avid yoga practitioner, and that is sort of the only thing that keeps me tethered to sanity. So I think everyone should do yoga.
Definitely. How often a week?
So you're catching me. So typically I do 4 to 5 days a week, but this past week I didn't do it at all, and it cost me. So I was like, I had a really low quality of life for the past week. But before that, I was on a good 4 to 5 day a week.
That centers you. I get it.
Yep.
Nice. Julia, what message would you put on all school marquees across the globe if you could do so for just one day?
It's a good question. It's almost becoming a cliche, so I'm cringing as I say this, but something to the effect of students at the center. And I mean that sort of both in how we design schools, we should be designing them with students at the center, but also affording students voice and leadership alongside that.
Great. And like I said, Julia, I really enjoyed this conversation. Congratulations. You've made it to the end. This question is a doozy. So good luck here, but I can't wait to hear how you'll answer it. You're building a school from the ground up. You're not limited by any resources. Your only limitation is your imagination. How would you build your dream school, and what would be your top three priorities?
Okay. Yeah. I'm like sweating a little bit with this one. It's almost too much choice. So I kind of alluded to this when I was talking, but I think creating a school that was fundamentally more porous so that more people could get in and more kids could get out. And I think from a sort of, what was the top three priorities?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So from a top three priorities there, I think starting that school with all of the latent community assets in mind. And I think a lot of leaders do this naturally and intuitively, but school systems were sort of built as these separate institutions from all the other institutions around them. So to be able to start from scratch and think of museums and libraries and businesses as all part of the assets at a school's disposal, I think we would start to design really differently. And also design it with attention to the priorities of the community rather than the state or the federal government. So that's like one design principle. I think the second would be sort of thinking of learning and connecting in tandem so that every moment that a young person is learning is also a moment of connection, whether that's with his peers, his teacher, or a sort of non-teacher adult in the community. And then the last principle is, and this is my new soapbox that I'm just getting on every day, so you have to listen to me talk about it.
But hey, I invite you on the show. That's okay.
Exactly. You sign yourself up for this. But a school that treats relationships as outcomes, not inputs. Because I think we've completely flipped the script on that in traditional ed reform and school design, where the outcomes are all academics and skills and even SEL skills and all that. And we think of relationships as inputs. But the reality is that it's relationships that help us get by and get ahead. And if we don't start treating them as outcomes, we're not doing right by young people.
Well, thanks, Julia, for being on the show. If guests want to follow up with you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Totally. So at Twitter, I am Julia F. Freeland, and ChristiansenInstitute.org has all of our research. And then lastly, if you're an educator interested in using some of the technologies we talked about, we keep a running list and sort of database of all those technologies at whoyouknow.org.
All right. And we'll link all those up for the listeners in today's show notes. Thanks again for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate it.
All right, better leaders, just a few more things before you take off. I created a new resource for you called The 3 Leadership Questions I Ask Every Day. You can download the resource by visiting betterleadersbetterschools.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. This helps me in a few ways. It gives the show some social proof, it encourages new people to listen to the show, and it improves the ranking of the show and therefore helps me serve more school leaders. If you want extra credit and some good vibes, share your biggest takeaway from the show and tag me on Twitter and Instagram. My handle is Alien Earbud, an anagram for my name, Daniel Bauer, and make sure to use the hashtag BLBS. This Sunday is the weekend resource. Join over 3,000 school leaders that get this resource delivered every week. In the weekend resource, I share content curated specifically for school leaders. You'll get articles, videos, templates and exercises, coaching tips, inspirational quotes, invitations to free Friday group coaching, which is an exclusive offer made available only to newsletter subscribers in the Better Leaders, Better Schools tribe, and links to all the content I created for you this past week. You can subscribe at betterleadersbetterschools.com/weekend-resource. And remember, life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader.